This is Dr. Michael Bricky with Ageless Lifestyles Radio, cutting-edge thinking for being youthful at every age. On each program, I interview experts on what it takes to live longer, healthier, and happier. Today's show is How Storytelling Can Help Your Health and Longevity. My 9-year-old twins are on book 6 of Harry Potter. My college student's son and daughter watched a lot of Star Wars and Ring movies, and my wife watches a lot of science fiction TV. And yes, I love Desperate Housewives. We crave stories and have lots of stories about success in business and sports, but few about how to age well. We met today's guest, Dr. Neil Fiore, author of Coping with the Emotional Impact of Cancer, when he shared with us the psychological strategies that he developed that helped him overcome a, quote, terminal cancer diagnosis 30 years ago. He is a master at storytelling and hypnosis, and today shares with us how stories can help us live healthier, happier, and longer lives. Dr. Fiore, welcome.
It's an honor to be with you, Mike.
Milton Erickson is largely regarded as the world's best hypnotist of all time. And he changed hypnosis from what we think of as swinging the watch and the power relationship to hypnotizing people by telling stories and other indirect ways. Dr. Fiore, how did you get connected with Milton Erickson?
Well, you might be familiar with NLP, Neuro-Linguistic Programming, which was very popular actually just in the 70s when I was a new psychologist at the University of California, Berkeley, at their counseling center. And Bandler and Grinder, the founders of NLP, Neuro-Linguistic Programming, we're putting on a seminar, and six of us, six psychologists in the area, got together with them afterwards, and they insisted, they said, go see Milton Erickson. And we all wrote, and we got, six of us got to travel to Phoenix in 1977, spend 4 days with him for about 5 hours a day, and then I came back the following year. And by that time, in 78, Erickson was world famous through a number of things that Bandler and Grinder put out and some books by Jay Haley. And there were people from all over the world literally sitting at his feet, a crowded little office, people speaking many different languages. And I spent one more day, and I said, I got to go back and study this more and read it more, but I don't necessarily need to be here. I had my personal, in 77, my personal contact with quite a few hours with Erickson in 77.
Were you constantly in a trance when you were trying to learn from him? I mean, how do you remember what he said?
Anyone who knows Erickson's stories and so on knows that he only told stories. People would ask questions. These were psychologists, psychiatrists, physicians from all around the world. And they would ask him a question, and he would begin by telling a story. And within 10 to 30 minutes, everyone in the room would be in a trance. And what was really strange, because we would discuss these events at dinner, the six of us, and then we would dream intensely, and then we'd wake in the morning and discuss our dreams at breakfast, and then go to see Erickson again about 10 a.m. And what was amazing was we each would kind of compete like kids and say, well, no, that story was for me. Well, did you hear this part of the story? Because, no, I didn't hear that part of it. No, that part was for me. And we each heard what we needed to hear. And we had a kind of amnesia for the other part of the story. And he had a way of lowering his voice and nodding and then catching your eye and saying, yes, that's right. Now close your eyes and go back to when you first discovered your belly button. And that's what he did with me when I asked about a somnambulistic or sleepwalking trance. And in fact, I could feel silky skin, I could smell baby smells, I could see my grandmother's ceiling, and people in the room told me that I was kicking my... So apparently he sent me back after about a 20-minute story, challenging me in various ways to kind of confuse my conscious mind. And the main thing with hypnosis or daydreaming or operating creatively is to get your conscious mind out of the way. And he was a master at doing that.
It was a master at both picking up on the little small movements that you would make and leading with those and pacing those and deepening those, and then a master at really knowing what you needed to hear and spinning it into a story.
You're very right by saying pacing, because he used what the client brought in. He didn't impose anything, really. He used the client's language and the client's movements, the client's movement of one hand versus the other hand, and so on. So he was really using or utilizing, in fact, it's called utilization method, utilizing and pacing with the person. So it's a dance in which you dance at the pace of your partner. Regardless of how good or fast you are, you really match them.
Which is the exact opposite of what most people think of with hypnosis.
That's right. Mm-hmm. So, and what he left you with was a belief in the wisdom and beneficence of your subconscious mind. The wisdom and beneficence of your own body, and the ability to learn, and the ability to stand on your own two feet, even though as a toddler you fell, even though you hit your head, even though you cried, something in you, and something that was communicated by the gaze of your parents, that look that said, yes, that hurts, you're shocked, you're in pain, and soon you're going to want to stand up on your own two feet, and you're going to want to take another step, and you're going to one day ride a bicycle, perhaps ride a horse, ride in a jet plane. And it was that incredible expectancy, that look, that you will recover, you will stand on your own two feet. You have everything that you need right inside of you.
And Erickson was a physician, a psychiatrist, and we normally think of physicians as being the authority figure telling us what we need to do. And again, this is the exact opposite of all the healing is within you, the answers are within you, and he was just facilitating what you needed.
Yes, and I love the phrase which I've taken on, which is, soon you will know something you don't know yet. And it will come to you, and whenever you need it, you will have the right knowledge. It will come from the back of your mind to the front of your mind to the tips of your fingers, and you will know something you don't know yet.
So of all the Erickson stories you heard, what was your favorite?
Well, it's hard to choose a favorite, but when I saw him, I just was in recovery from cancer, terminally diagnosed cancer with lots of chemotherapy and surgery. And I asked him about what to tell cancer patients. What do I tell cancer patients? And he responded with a long story that went something like, I'll give you an abbreviated version, but a boat went out on Lake Michigan, and a storm came up, and the boat capsized 13 miles from shore. Now, there were folks on that boat who struggled hard to swim to shore, but 13 miles was too much for them, and so they gave up, or they exhausted themselves. There were others who didn't even try. There was only one survivor, and that was a 12-year-old girl who was found the next morning moving her hands in the sand, saying to herself over and over again, I can take one more stroke, I can take one more stroke, I can take one more stroke. And whether or not it was meant for cancer patients or for me personally, it meant a lot to me that just to focus on what I can do now, to take one stroke, even if I'm overwhelmed with the task of surviving cancer or the task of living 20 years or so, as I have now, 30 years. I'm going to take it one day at a time. I'm going to do what I can. I'm going to take one more step. And I'm kind of reminded of the Serenity Prayer to focus on what you can do, what you do control, your attitude, your own personal atmosphere all around you. But to take that one more step. Yeah.
What were some of the other stories you particularly found helpful?
I remember there was a psychiatrist in the room. I asked a question about his own therapy. And Erickson, you know, I was wondering why, because I was a little bit out of this now. I got to observe. And Erickson told a story about this person who he knew, who had been a terrible juvenile delinquent. I mean, he hurt animals, he burnt down barns, and he was in and out of reformatory school since he was about 12, and eventually was put in prison at the age of 19 or 20, and remained in prison for about 7 years or so, longer than that, I believe. A lot of it because he was so violent, a lot of that was in solitary confinement. And when he was released in the town in which Erickson was a boy, when he was released, immediately there were at least three robberies. But there was a dance that night, and this fellow, let's call him Bill, is walking down the street, and he meets Maggie, and he looks over Maggie, and Maggie looks over him because she's the farmer's daughter, a very strong woman. And he says, "Would you go to the dance with me tonight?" "Well, would you dance with me tonight?" And she says, "Yes, if you're a gentleman." And he dances with her. In fact, he has every dance with her, and pretty soon he's working at her father's farm. The next day, all the stolen property is returned. He works for a year or two, and they start sparking, they start dating, and they get married. And when it's Erickson's chance to go to college and to go to medical school, this Bill says to Erickson, "You go to medical school. Don't stay a farmer. And when you get to the state hospital, you look up my records." And Erickson then fixes this psychiatrist who was talking about years of psychoanalysis. Mm. And he says to him, "And all those years of imprisonment, solitary confinement, violence, an incorrigible child, all those years, and the only therapy he got." And now he raises his head and he looks at the psychiatrist. "Yes, if you'll be a gentleman." And I'm sure that had some personal meaning to that man, but it was chilling and thrilling to me to hear that. Yeah. And it was that contact that someone who seemed hopeless was able to change with such little therapy.
Did Erickson talk much about aging?
I know he talked about his father having had a heart attack, and the doctor said, "Well, you know, you have about 6 months to live, and you'll need to stay in the hospital for some time." And the father said, "No, I'll take those 6 months, and I'll add on another 6 years." And this happened about three different times, but Erickson's father lived through those heart attacks at least another 10 or 15 years. Remember that? And of course, a lot of people don't understand that Erickson was in terrible pain a lot of the time, because he had two bouts of polio, one when he was 17, which actually led him to learn a lot of his own methods, because he learned to control his pain, but also to take control over his body, because he was supposed to die the next day when he was struck with polio at 17. By the way, he was due to go to the University of Wisconsin on a track scholarship, and that was stopped. Mm. But as he was sitting in the rocking chair on this working farm with seven of his siblings coming in and out, and his parents, he's not supposed to be able to move, and yet one day, curious and interested about who's coming up the walk, because he cannot figure it out. He now knows, because he was so perceptive, he now knows the mood of every person, and if it's his sister or his brother and who it is, but he couldn't figure it out this day, and suddenly the rocking chair is moving. And so he emphasized that, wondering who's out there moving some muscle somewhere in his body, and he worked on that, and then he used imagery and practice, mental rehearsal, to practice throwing a ball, throwing a javelin, running track, until he got more and more muscles moving. And then by that summer, which is approximately 9 months later, after being struck with polio, he is able to take a canoe to build up his upper body. And the following year, next September, with a cane, he goes to the University of Wisconsin.
Mm.
Amazing. And then at the age of 52 or so, polio came back, and it was really ripping the ligaments from his muscles.
How did he deal with the pain?
He used trance. He went through his entire body. He also employed his wife, with it. When he was working with someone, I think he was totally removed by being focused on the task of working with other people with polio, other people with incredible pain, psychological and physical, because there is no sign of it. I've seen lots of films of him, and there's no sign that he was in pain.
So he was so engrossed in what he was doing that it was all tuned out.
Exactly. And I've heard the same thing about musicians who might have arthritis in their 80s or whatever, but they've got a young student coming in, and for 2 hours they are pain-free, focused on the music, focused on that student. I had a man who had cancer to the bone. He was about 82. He would not close his eyes. He didn't believe in hypnosis, and I just started talking to him, as I have many people, I guess indirect hypnosis. Started talking about when he was a young man, and I knew that he had skied at Lake Tahoe in California. Asked him about that, what it must have been like to be 20 years old, my God, 60 years ago, skiing at Lake Tahoe, what the clothes were like, what the skis were like, how cold it must have been on his legs, the strength in his legs coming down that hill in that cold. It was just wool, you know, there was no Gore-Tex. Heavy skis, my goodness, I don't even know. He had a tow rope or some kind, and quite often just walk up the top of the mountain yourself. And within a few minutes, he wound up closing his eyes, and he had another 20 or 30 minutes of pain-free time, thinking about that snow and that cold and the strength in his legs.
So part of that is that you're getting his mind focused on something else, and part of it is that you're bringing back even muscle memories of a time when he was free of pain and very strong and able.
Yes, and I recall some men who had real phobias about surgery because he'd been through 8 surgeries after a terrible car accident, and I started again. When I'm a little bit stuck about, you know, what's going on positive in this person, I'll start asking about, geez, what went right? My God, everything was so awful. Is there anything good? And, you know, he just glows and says, yeah, you know, I was adopted, and I was in this great restaurant in New York, and I was raised by these people, and I got a football scholarship, and I used to dance at the Waldorf Astoria. And there he is. He's literally, his mind is floating outside his body. He's dancing at the Waldorf Astoria, and I could see him in a tuxedo, you know.
See him swaying, huh?
Yeah. And again, his phobia is gone, his fear is gone, he's pain-free, and you get that look of recognition. Go, yeah, that's right, now you know what to do. Just bring that story with you. Here, play this tape, go back to that story, dance at the Waldorf Astoria, play football, and re-experience those neural connections, those neural muscle connections, bringing it back alive, just the way a famous pianist can do, someone playing the cello can do, even if they have arthritis. Somehow it brings it back, just the way Erickson did with polio, remembering what it was like to throw a javelin, to throw a baseball, to run track, to work in the fields, and bringing back those muscles and those nerve muscle connections.
So someone may be thinking, well, gee, I don't have a Milton Erickson or a Neil Fiore to tell me magical stories. But actually what you're describing is something that we all can do, of intensely remembering very able times in our lives and totally associating into that experience. And when we do that, the pain gets set aside.
Yes, and of course, pain, and whether it's psychological or emotional, can be in our complete attention. That's the only thing there is. And when you begin to look at the sky, feel your feet, become very mindful of your breathing, it becomes smaller. And then, is it the size of a basketball? Is it the size of a grapefruit? Is it the size of an orange? But what part of you feels good? Is your left toe fine? Is your right ear fine? Because as you begin to pay attention to the parts of you that are functioning, your brain focuses on that instead. And whatever part of you is in pain begins to diminish. becomes smaller, a smaller part of your attention, it's at least contextualized. It's in a larger context.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I remember being in a lot of pain, psychological and emotional, after a number of losses and deaths and the breakup of a relationship, and I'm walking across the campus at the University of Maryland, and a firecracker goes off, and I am taken out from kind of a hangdog, head down, just focus on that pain in my gut, and I look up, and I go, oh my God, the sky's blue, the trees are green, there are dogs, there are frisbees, you know, there are people. God, it's a beautiful campus. Oh yeah, oh that's right, and I'm depressed, I'm in pain. And I did that several times until the depression and pain was contextualized into this place. And I'm walking, and my legs are strong. I feel good. Oh, yeah. And, of course, there are these losses, and there's this pain. Until, you know, finally, it was a small part of my overall attention. You know?
So we were talking about physical pain initially, but the same principles apply to psychological pain, like depression, anxiety, despair. And you're talking about recontextualizing it, or you could also take a bigger picture of, we tell ourselves stories about who we are and what we're about, and if that breakup in the relationship, the story we tell ourselves is, I'm a loser, nobody wants me, that kind of thing, it's a script for depression. And if we tell ourselves, took a kick in the stomach, but I'm going to get up and be with other people, and I'll find somebody else.
Yeah. Yeah. So now you're reminding me my favorite story.
Okay.
So Norman Cousins wrote the foreword to my book, which is now Coping with the Emotional Impact of Cancer, Being an Active Patient. Norman Cousins was a fan of hypnosis and a fan of Milton Erickson, but he'd never met anyone who had been with Erickson. And Norman Cousins was a fan of positive emotions. And I would argue with him, and I would say, I am the Darth Vader of emotions. I like what you call the negative emotions. Actually, I don't believe there are negative emotions. I just think there are emotions. So let me tell you what Erickson said to his 4-year-old son who fell down the stairs. So Erickson told us this story. Anyway, it was my 4-year-old son falls down the stairs, puts his teeth through his lip, he's bleeding profusely, and what does the famous hypnotist say to his son? Does he say, 1, 2, 3, it's all over, it doesn't hurt? No, he doesn't say that at all. He says, that's awful. You're in a lot of pain, and you're bleeding. At least 3 validations. At least 3 validating before you move on. That's awful. You're in a lot of pain. You're bleeding. You're bleeding bright, red, strong blood that's cleansing your wound. And if you're lucky, we'll give you a scar bigger than your sister Betty Alice. Now, that becomes a formula. It's yes, yes, yes. At least 3 yeses, at least 3 confirmations, and it's usually the client who's nodding, yes, that's right. Yes, it is awful. Yes, I am in pain. Yes, I am bleeding. Yes, it is bright red. I didn't know it was strong. And you're right. I could be connected with my siblings. Betty Alice had 15 stitches. Lance had only 10. And Milton Erickson is saying this to his 4-year-old. If you're lucky, you might get 10. You might beat Lance, but Betty Alice. So without an anesthetic, Robert, the 4-year-old, is counting the stitches, hoping for another stitch.
Mm-hmm.
He is an active participant in his healing, which Norman Cousins understood very well, to be an active patient, an active participant. And the 4-year-old is counting the stitches, hoping for another stitch, being egged on by his father, telling him, well, Betty Alice had 15. And then in 1980, the year that Erickson died, Robert and the children were there telling their stories, and Robert said, and when he told me that it was awful, that I was in pain, that I was bleeding, I knew that he understood, and I was ready to listen to any suggestion he had. And so that was wonderful. Now Robert was, my goodness, I guess he was 34.
And so what's going on is you get these 3 validations that ring very true for you, and you're feeling that this person really knows what's going on. This person is an expert, and He knows what's going on with me emotionally. He cares. So now I'm ready to believe whatever he says, and Erickson slips in a little stretch to take him a new direction.
Exactly. And in that sense, it's like pacing. It's like dancing. It's like, yes, we're taking this step, we're taking this step, we're taking this step, and now we're turning around and getting a new view of things. So when you talk to yourself, do you say, it's okay, don't worry, it doesn't hurt? A part of you's got to say, well, that's not true at all. You're lying. To maintain credibility with yourself and I think your body, you need to be say yes, that hurts. Yes, you're afraid. Yes, you don't know what to do. And now I'm here with access to a deeper subconscious, to a left brain and right brain, to an autonomic nervous system, to the wisdom in the universe. You are not alone worrying about this. I'm on your side. I will not make you feel bad about this. Even though you are human, even though you are vulnerable, I accept you completely. Yes, that's awful. Yes, you're afraid. Yes, and now, and is a bridge. AND is a bridge out of the past, out of the split-off fearful part, out of the primitive brain, to the higher brain in the present moment. Now, not in the past when you had limited coping skills, but now, connected to your stronger self, which is in my book, Awaken Your Strongest Self, which is on my website, neilfiore.com, NEILFIORE.com. Back to that strongest self, lighting up your human forehead, your prefrontal cortex, being able to calm down the other parts of you. So it's very powerful when you speak that way to yourself, validating first.
So it's interesting, the same formula that Erickson uses for hypnosis, we can use in our self-talk. And I hadn't caught before that it often involves a shift from a more primitive brain to more conscious brain.
From fight-flight brain, mammal brain, primate brain, to the human forehead, the only place of choice, the prefrontal cortex, the human forehead, where the only place on the planet where we can choose to face something that's frightening or fearful or overwhelming, just the way our ancestors first began to face the fear of fire and override the mammal brain fear of fire and harness it. So, yeah.
We're talking with Dr. Neil Fiore, who is a psychologist in private practice in Berkeley, California. He is the author of Coping with the Emotional Impact of Cancer, as well as Conquering Test Anxiety and Awaken Your Strongest Self, and The Now Habit, and several CDs. And you're also a top executive coach and a professional speaker.
Yes.
How did you clone yourself?
How did I clone myself? Don't you say? I wish I could, actually, so I could take a rest. A lot of these things evolved organically, one from the other. The pivotal point, perhaps, was getting cancer at the age of 32 and dealing with it in a way that the doctors didn't expect. And then from that, they asked me to make a videotape for other patients coping with chemotherapy. And then from that, they asked me to speak at Grand Rounds, speak to doctors about it. And then the script that I wrote for that video and the speech I put together in an article that was rejected by the American Medical Association Journal, JAMA, and also by the New England Journal of Medicine. So then I rewrote it to include a lot more of the medical information that I had to learn. And it was accepted by the New England Journal of Medicine and published in February of 1979. And then that led to 50 speeches that year, letters from about 150 countries. And then I was on my way to a speaking career and training career and so on. So a lot of it actually had to do with turning lemons into lemonade, I suppose.
Yeah. It's like John Kennedy, when they asked him how he became a hero, he said, well, they sunk my ship.
Yes, very good. Exactly right. And so, yeah, then all that information, including that article of the New England Journal of Medicine, they were really the kernels and the seeds of my book, the first version of Coping with the Emotional Impact of Cancer. The first version was published in 1984. Yeah, then that led to, every book has led to some television and radio, and of course that it kind of builds on itself.
Of the books you've written, which one is the most Ericksonian?
Well, I guess Awaken Your Strongest Self. Awaken Your Strongest Self, Break Free of Stress, Inner Conflict, that's procrastination, and self-sabotage, because it is an integration around your higher brain, overriding your fight-flight-fear brain, overriding your mammal brain, and those concerns about the society and shaming, overriding the obsessive-compulsive nature of the primate monkey brain, and living more from your higher self in line with your leadership mission and vision and values, and a real positive belief in your, in the wisdom in your body and the wisdom in your subconscious. So Awaken Your Strongest Self is really kind of summarizes and really is a manual for the way in which I do my therapies.
So you could do some of it yourself.
That's right. That's right. And you start with where you are now, observing your default voices, because the brain is like a computer. It's efficient, and it provides you your favorites. It gives you your defaults, and it requires a human brain choice to override those defaults and change the margins that Bill Gates puts in there and override the favorites and say, oh, no, thank you. I'm not going to smoke a cigarette at this point. No, I don't need to check my email. I am, in fact, choosing, and I use the word choice repeatedly, because it only exists in the human brain, and it builds up your leadership power every time you choose to do something and take responsibility as a mature human being. The other parts of you relax. Finally, the leader has shown up. Hopefully, this time, it's an understanding, compassionate leader. Both a leader and compassion. Yes, I understand better than anyone else what that feels like, and now I'm here, and I will choose how to behave in line with my higher human values.
I often think of the brain in computer terms, and one of the things that fascinates me is somebody who really knows how to do some programming could take an old 286 computer or something and do miracles with it, whereas somebody could have the latest and greatest $5,000 computer and not know much more than how to play solitaire.
Yeah, that's right. Yes. Yeah. And so many of us are operating at the animal level of reacting to life, so that our fears and our needs cause us to react in particular ways. That's a two-step dance. We have a fear, we have a need, and we react. The human, however, has the ability to have the same fear, the same need, and to choose how to act in a way that is congruent, consistent, integrated, aligned with your higher values. So that requires, again, a leadership function from your human forehead, from your human brain, to put out a vision and a mission about the way in which you will live your life. For example, in inner peace. It's one of my highest values. I want to stop inner conflict. I want to break the conflict between you have to and I don't want to, and choose what to do and take human brain responsibility for whatever I'm doing.
And I think a lot of aging is about getting more emotional control, about not being so concerned about peer pressure. And what you're talking about is, hey, we can speed up that process by programming our own brains, just like we program our own computers, if we take the time to learn how to do it, tell ourselves good stories, and use the observation, then pace on to more positive directions that you said is the crux of the Erickson formula.
Yes, yeah. And I have a number of free articles, including a centering exercise on my website, which is neilfiore.com, N-E-I-L-F-I-O-R-E. It's also in my book, The Now Habit, Overcoming Procrastination, want to join guilt-free play. But one of the things that's missing from a lot of people, including some very successful people, is this understanding of rewarding all steps in the right direction. If you were training a dog, you would know that you say, good boy, that's right. If you continue to criticize the animal, it'll become neurotic. Or we're doing the same thing with our brain. In fact, instead of congratulating yourself for starting on a project or getting started for 10 minutes or 30 minutes, people are criticizing themselves for not starting earlier. So these are some of the problems of procrastinators, is this self-criticism. Instead of, that was good, that was good, that was great, all steps in the right direction. In fact, Martin Seligman, I got to hear him speak last week at the Evolution Psychology Conference, and he now has a contract with the Army to train 40,000 drill sergeants in positive psychology. Amazing. Amazing breakthrough for psychology and for the Army. And he says people lessen depression and they increase their happiness if they simply write down three things that went well every day and how they caused those things to happen. Focusing your brain on what went well, similar to gratitude, I suppose. Focusing on what went well. That went well. That was good. I want more of that. And your brain gives you serotonin without Prozac. It gives you that little burst of serotonin. It gives you that dopamine. It says, that was good. And then your brain reinforces you, you see, and gets you happier and lowers depressive symptoms. Now, the funny thing about that research is they asked people to do that for 1 week. Write down every day three things that you did that went well and how you caused them. And the people continued on their own for over 6 months. And they were significantly less depressed and happier than the control group who did something else, right? Amazing. Which means they were getting dopamine in their brain. Their brain, before going to sleep, was beginning to give them the serotonin, that relaxation hormone, and the dopamine, that motivation hormone, in the morning. They were motivated to do it, and they continued with it.
And this is a therapy that can take 5 minutes.
Exactly right. Yeah. Right. Of course, we know there are just so many negative things going on. In fact, I like to say that a lot of clinical hypnosis is really dehypnotizing people from all the negativity and brainwashing they got. You know. By the way, one of the other things I learned from Erickson, and I learned in my own practice that has been so effective in preparing people for surgery, preparing people for chemotherapy, is to go from worry to wonder. To go from worrying, furrowing your brow, holding your breath, hold it more, hold your breath, tighten your muscles, furrow your brow consciously, and then exhale and release, and open your hands, open your fists, and wonder what your body will do with that energy. Be curious and interested about what the killer T cells will do in your body. You, as a consciousness, don't need to be worrying and telling a killer T cell what to do. It knows how to go after those cancer cells. It knows how to cooperate with radiation, chemotherapy, and surgery. You go from worry to wonder, and you do not hold stress for more than 2 to 5 seconds. Inhale, hold your breath, tighten your muscles, furrow your brow, tighten further, and then exhale, release, and float down and feel the chair, feel the floor, feel the bed, and go from worry to wonder. Hand that energy over to the greater wisdom of your mind and body. That has been amazing in lowering the stress hormone, so that all of my patients have brought back stories about where the doctor was amazed at how fast the surgery went, how well they did, and how quickly they recovered with minimal discomfort, hardly any pain. Practicing going from worry to wonder, which means you're not going to hold stress and worry for more than 5 seconds without taking a deep breath.
So part of that was shifting to the wonder, and part of it was relaxation. Part of it that people might have missed is feeling the chair, the environment, and getting tuned into, as they say, the here and now.
Yes, and feeling the support of the chair and floor, that you are not alone, you are connected to the universe, your consciously controlled muscles can let go, and you are still held. In fact, until you let go of holding, until you let go of struggling, you will not discover that, in fact, you are held, you are not alone, you are supported externally by the laws of nature, and internally by your autonomic nervous system, the genius of your subconscious mind, and your right brain. You, as a consciousness, are not alone, and you're very right. Three-part breathing, you inhale, you hold and tighten, you tighten your muscles to replicate the stress response, and then you release, and as you exhale, you are communicating, I have decided it is safe to exhale, and I am floating down and accepting the support of something larger and wiser than me. You are not alone.
We'll get back to Dr. Neil Fiore in just a moment. Dr. Fiore gives you a feel for Erickson hypnosis. What if you could have your own anti-aging Ericksonian hypnosis session anytime you want, a session that would let you effortlessly absorb my anti-aging suggestions? And what if the session also helped you with any insomnia, helping you effortlessly drift off to sleep at night? That's exactly what my Reverse Aging, Hypnotic Journeys to Ageless Lifestyles DVDs do. John David Jones, who's worked with Della Reese, Gladys Knight, and many other celebrities, added original four-track music that hugs my words. My books, Defy Aging and 52 Baby Steps to Grow Young, address your conscious beliefs about aging. It's also enormously helpful to address your subconscious beliefs about aging as well. And, of course, to get a good night's sleep and to relax. To get the first DVD, or the whole set of six, just go to drbricke.com. That's drbricke.com. And now back to Dr. Neil Fiore. Now, you also said that you use REM deep relaxation. Are we talking about the same thing, or is that slightly different?
It might start the same. It might start in three-part breathing, but that's usually deeper relaxation. It might take 10 or 20 minutes, but it's useful to get into a stress-free environment and to carry that bubble with you all day long. If your listeners, for example, were to imagine all around them, above, below, right, left, front and back, 3 to 4 feet all around is an atmosphere, which there is, at sea level it weighs 14.7 pounds per square inch. It's thick, it carries the sound of my voice, and it slows down the noises from the outside, just the way the Earth's atmosphere burns up the meteorites before they reach your heart. Also, your atmosphere slows things down. It slows down negative vibes, but also slows down your own concerns and worries and gives you all the time in the world to push them aside and step aside, because things as they enter your atmosphere are slower and you can move them aside and say, oh no, thank you. You are safe within your bubble. And you bounce from event to event, making sure any ego part that wants to go out there and struggle beyond the atmosphere, you catch it and bring it back in and choose to be calm and at peace inside of that bubble. Well, that's the kind of imagery I would use with anyone coping with an illness, because you really want this protective atmosphere that brings you into a REM-level sleep while still awake. You are walking around. In fact, most of these exercises are done sitting up. In fact, I have a whole series called HypnosisNetwork.com. HypnosisNetwork.com. Whole series, but again, people can find those on my website, neilfiore.com. And there's a way of staying as much as possible in that REM state. I know, before I knew about this consciously, the week while I was deciding what to do after being told at the age of 32 that I could be dead in 1 year, that I had terminal cancer that had already spread to my lung, that I was in that kind of a sleepwalking trance and I was going to the medical library, and I was writing down information. I was getting a second opinion, a third opinion. I was talking to people. I was making decisions. I was in a protective bubble. And I also experienced that when I was attempting to sell this book, Walking the Streets of Manhattan, going from publisher to publisher with my own manuscripts before I got an agent. For 1 week, I could be on the subway. I could Xerox copies of it, of my manuscript. I could call up another publisher. And amazingly, I got into 15 publishers in Manhattan. It was amazing. But I was calm, even on the subway, in that bubble. And so you want to, as much as possible, lower your brainwave frequency. By the way, it's about 26 cycles per second when you worry, when you do math problems. And when you're exhaling and you're breathing slowly, you lower your blood pressure, you calm yourself down, it drops to about 10 cycles per second, which, by the way, is a good frequency for picking up your dreaming mind's thoughts and solutions, picking up the right frequency, radio frequency, as it were, where you pick up your creativity and you're much more creative. And you have a kind of ESP. I don't know if you find this, but I found that with my clients, when I do hypnosis work, all of a sudden I become clearer and I have greater ESP about what's going on with them.
Well, I think because we're relaxed, our five to seven things that our short-term memory can pay attention to aren't all filled up with a bunch of self-talk, and we can notice more what's going on.
Exactly right. So why would you want to operate your computer from your RAM, your random access short-term memory, when in fact 95% of the brain and the computer is over there? You know, all around that left ear, the 5% over the left ear, that's the bounded sense of the self. So let's expand your identity. That's what the book Awaken Your Strongest Self is about. It's like, let's change your identity, or at the very least expand it to include more of your brain cell power. And that was another phrase of Erickson's, you know, your brain cell power. And you can let this set and gel and be inscribed in your brain cell power, coming from the back of your mind to the front of your mind whenever you need it. But there's a sense of it coming to you. It comes to your true self. You don't have to know right now. Something will come to you. Now, children know this. Children under the age of 6 know this before the brain splits into left and right hemispheres, before the ego splits. They know they can show up. You ask any 4-year-old, how did you draw that? How did you know to put those toys that way? How did you create that story? And invariably, they shrug and say, I don't know. It was easy. It just comes to me. As if saying, isn't work that way, you know? You show up and you get to play with your inner genius and something comes to you.
And I think a lot of senior moments and that kind of thing are people have both psyched themselves out of, set up beliefs and stories that they can't remember things, and then they've clogged up their short-term memory, so there's no room for the memory to arise from our more unconscious or the hard drive of our mental computers.
Yeah, and it's trying too hard with just your conscious muscles, and anyone who has played any sport knows if you just try with your conscious muscles to swing a golf club or a tennis racket, it's not as efficient as being relaxed and allowing your body and your body's innate wisdom of physics and anatomy to do that for you. Only your ego doesn't get to say, wow, I'm terrific, I tried hard and I did it. You get to say, I don't know, it was easy. And that easiness for some people is an insult, because they're so brainwashed into a puritanical view that life's about struggle and trying hard, when in fact it's humility and being grateful and going, wow, that was easy. Boy, that's interesting.
Again, the stories and beliefs that we program ourselves with. When you were talking about the bubble, some people might look at that and say, oh, that's pretty weird stuff. But if you stop and think about it, people have a certain distance. And in our country, that distance is pretty big. In countries like Japan, it's much smaller. But somebody steps too close and talks too close to your face or something, and you tense up. So we already have that sense of this bubble around us, but we normally think of it in terms of nobody better violate that distance that I'm entitled to, as opposed to this. When I was a kid, it was Colgate toothpaste had this invisible protective shield around your teeth.
That's right. And this is your personal space. And the truth is, it's a scientific fact that the air weighs 14.7 pounds per square inch at sea level. So it is thick, it's viscous, we're really like fish in an ocean. If we could see the water or the air around us, in fact, it's the same air that's able to hold up an aeroplane. So it has to be thick. And of course, we know that people flying around in space, way up there above sea level, can float around because they don't have this air pressure holding them down. So it is all around us. It's just using this imagery to slow things down. And when I've been in that state, when I've used that bubble, I heard myself say on several occasions, oh, normally that would have bothered me. Normally that would have gotten to me. And at that moment, I know my bubble is working for me. And things are slowed down, and I reassert my vision and my mission about what I'm about, and I'm really clear about where I'm going. But I'm just going to let that little bullet or that arrow go by, and I get out of the way. That I don't have to take that on. And however you imagine it, it's that you are in a protective state, and your radar is out there for you. You don't need to be trying so hard. And people have ways of saying that. Well, I don't know. My ego doesn't know. My conscious mind doesn't know. I'll have to sleep on it.
Mm-hmm.
Conscious mind goes to sleep. Oh, I don't know, it'll come to me. It will come to me means I get out of the way with my conscious identity, and I let my subconscious work on it, what I call the night shift. Let them work on it, and it'll come to me, you know. And then it'll be interesting. You know, I can't figure it out yet. It'll be interesting to see what happens. All of those are common phrases that people use to indicate that they know their subconscious is working for them and something will come to their conscious mind. But you must get the conscious mind out of the way. Anyone who's an artist or creative knows that.
Mm-hmm. Well, we have time for one more question. I want to be sure to ask you, what's your take on the law of attraction?
Well, the law of attraction gives too much responsibility, I have to use that word carefully, I suppose, to our ego. And as children, we are capable, as infants, we are capable of making our mother smile, of getting our father's attention, of making grandma happy. Oddly enough, when we are the most dependent is when we are the most powerful. And we develop what psychologists call an illusion of power, an illusion of being godlike. Now, the problem with that is there's a time around 18 months or 2 years where we fall out of grace, out of a Garden of Eden, out of unconditional love, because we're able to run around on our own and our parents have to say no to us. No, you can't run into the street. And all of a sudden we wonder what happened, and sometimes our parents are having another child or fighting among themselves. And if we hold on to that illusion of power, we then believe we are responsible and therefore guilty. That if I have the power, then I have the responsibility and I have the guilt, when in fact, we all fall from that Garden of Eden and we lose that power by the age of two for the most of us. And unfortunately, the law of attraction says you still have it, you still cause it, you still are that powerful. And I have to say to a lot of people, I'm sorry to tell you, you're just human. Instead of trying to be godlike, I say this especially to doctors and nurses, I'm sorry to tell you, but you can't do it all. You can't save everybody. And in some cases, I'm sorry, but you can't save your mother. Or you can't save your brother who's a drug addict. Or you can't save your lover who is a drug addict or has problems. I'm sorry, you're only human. And I'm sorry means we have to mourn and grieve a loss of that special magical time of being the special child. Unfortunately, in my opinion, the law of attraction feeds that guilt and that irrational level of responsibility. At the same time, I say do take responsibility as a human being from your human brain. choosing what to do, and do know that give your brain positive templates, give your brain positive images, because it will move in the positive direction. Reinforce all steps in the right direction. So, as you can see, I'm a little bit conflicted about it because I think there are pieces of truth there, but unfortunately, I think it feeds a lot of people's sense of guilt and hyper-responsibility when, in fact, we're just human. As Carl Jung said, the gods can do it all, but humans must choose. And in choosing, we become human. In choosing, that's our major advantage over animals. We can choose to face our fear. But it also is a reminder, we must choose, and therefore we must let go of something. We are human. We're not gods.
So the law of attraction was a little like Icarus wanting to attract the things that we feel we need in our life is one thing, but thinking that we can control everything and other people is getting too close to the sun.
Yes, right. In fact, again, we're back at the serenity prayer. Grant me serenity to accept those things I don't control, I can't change. Grant me the courage to work on that little bubble, that little area, which is my own attitude. You know, to paraphrase Viktor Frankl, when everything else was taken away from those people in the concentration camps, there remained one last human freedom, the freedom to choose your attitude, to choose human dignity.
We're talking with a very serene Dr. Neil Fiore. The website is neilfiore.com, which has lots of information about books, including Coping with the Emotional Impact of Cancer, Conquering Test Anxiety, Awaken Your Strongest Self, The Now Habit, various CDs, and lots of resources, information sheets. And I also wanted to remind people that you are an executive coach and a professional speaker, so
yes,
lots of different ways that people might want to tap into your services and skills. Neil, absolutely fascinating, and I really appreciate you sharing. For me, this was just so much fun.
For me, too, it's just an honor to be with you and an honor to be on your show. Thank you so much.
Commentary. It's such a delight talking with Dr. Neil Fiore. I thought it might help to give a little context for Ericksonian therapy compared to other psychotherapies. In the 1950s, Dr. Albert Ellis challenged Freudian psychology with how your thinking was wrong and in-your-face advice about what you should do. And Dr. Phil is the reincarnation of Albert Ellis. Also in the 1950s, Dr. Carl Rogers challenged Freudian psychology with his client-centered therapy, which became extremely popular. Rogers believed the answer was within the client and would lovingly feedback and paraphrase what the client said to help the client sort out things for himself or herself. With little credit, Rogerian therapy is the approach many personal coaching programs are teaching coaches these days. In the 1960s, Dr. B.F. Skinner developed radical behaviorism, which said that behavior change was all a matter of what you reinforce and what you punish. Eventually, cognitive behavioral therapy became the most popular form of therapy, using Skinner's reinforcement principles and Ellis's emphasis on what you think, the cognitive in the cognitive behavioral psychology. Like Rogers, Erickson believed that people have the wisdom already within them, but need guidance in finding them. But rather than just facilitating the client finding the answer within, Erickson assessed what the client needed and crafted stories to help the client discover and realize the solution. Which school of therapy is right? Well, if you only have a hammer, everything looks like a nail. Therapists who have a full toolkit tend to use their favorite tools, but also use a different tool if that's what the client needs. Comedians follow a rule of three in setting up jokes, two to set up the pattern and one to violate it. Dr. Fiore described how Erickson's rule of three was to give three validations. For example, Erickson acknowledged his son's pain and blood and fear before leading him a new direction with thoughts about bragging rights. NLP practitioners and hypnotists call this pacing where the client is and leading where the client needs to go. Neil is also very into thinking of the brain as a computer and taking control of the computer by overwriting problematic default programs. With depression, for example, merely by noting each day three things that went well and what you did to help that happen, you may not need Prozac. Finally, he places a lot of emphasis on quickly taking control of emotions by relaxing, inhaling, holding your breath, tensing your muscles, exhaling, connecting with your environment, in other words, feeling the chair, feeling the floor, feeling even the air, realizing that you're taking control, and focusing on the wonder instead of the worry. You are listening to Ageless Lifestyles on webtalkradio.net and permanently archived on agelesslifestyles.com. For example, if you like today's show, go to agelesslifestyles.com and give a listen to the show Neil and I did titled The Mental and Emotional Skills for Dealing with Cancer and Life-Threatening Diseases. For information on my anti-aging hypnosis DVDs, books, personal coaching, and keynote seminar services, just go to drbricke.com. That's drbricke.com. I'd love to hear your comments and suggestions. Send them to radio@agelesslifestyles.com. This is your anti-aging psychologist, Dr. Michael Bricke, thanking you for joining us on our quest to live longer, healthier, and happier.